Great. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Thursday, February 25th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And thank you, members. We have quite a few bills to get through. And for those in the audience, we intend to take up all the bills we have on the agenda here, but we will not necessarily be going in order, so you may have to bear with us. So we are going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 4046B. And Patrick is making a guest appearance briefly as our committee administrator. Would you like to tell us about this bill?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. House Bill 4046B increases the penalties for unlawful taking or killing of certain wildlife. It requires the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to revoke all licenses, tags, and permits issued pursuant to wildlife laws for certain offenses. Prohibits persons from applying for or obtaining license, tag, permit, or such license, tag, permit is revoked for a second time in 10-year period. It requires the court to order seizure or forfeiture of all guns, boats, vehicles, traps, and other implements used in committing offense upon third conviction within 10-year period for violation of provision of wildlife laws or rules adopted pursuant to wildlife laws. It specifies that each taking or killing of single animal constitutes a separate unlawful taking or killing. It prohibits a person from removing and utilizing only paws, gallbladder, sex organs, or bones from carcass of black bear or cougar, or eggs or carcass of sturgeon, salmon, or steelhead, unless engaged in lawful trapping activities or utilizing game mammals or game birds, declared by the commission rule to be inedible. It precludes violation of taking or killing occurred unintentionally when engaged in or otherwise lawful activity. It adds gray wolf to the list of game mammals for which a commission may institute suit for recovery of damages for unlawful taking or killing of wildlife. This measure comes to us with a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Madam Chair, and there are no amendments before the committee.
Okay, thank you, Patrick. And I see that we have Representative Krieger and Representative Helm both with us, two of the chief sponsors, so if you'd like to come forward. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep of District 1. I don't know if Representative Helm is before this committee. It's a tough committee. Watch what you say. House Bill 4046 did come out of the Natural Resource Committee in the House. And if you look, go back to 2011, it's a continuation of the work that Senator Boquist did when he increased the penalties on elk, 4-point bucks, and sturgeon, and did some work on raptors. We've expanded that some. It increases the civil value of wildlife that a court could award to the Department of Fish and Wildlife for illegal taking of that wildlife. That part of the section, more wildlife civil values weren't increased since 1970, with the exception of the ones I mentioned that we did in 2011. We did increase it very high for sheep, moose, and goats, and the reason for it is those animals don't get shot or harvested by an accidental hunt. Those are planned illegal activities, and those type of tags, if you go to the Rocky Mountain Elk Convention or SCI, are going between $50,000 and $150,000 for every one of them. So those things do have that kind of value to the state of Oregon. The bill does spell out conditions that call for a suspension. It provides that all guns, boats, vehicles, traps, fishing gear, electrical apparatus that are used in violations can be seized. Now, the existing law allows for that seizure. This bill would require the seizure of those things for the third violation in a 10-year period. Now, those are serious violations. The third time, if somebody hasn't learned it, maybe he doesn't need his pickup or his nice rifle or a nice boat if he's going to continue to do major violations and abuse the wildlife. It also increases license suspension for certain violations, gives the court the prerogative to do that. There was one part I wanted to read just briefly, and it was an amendment that the Oregon Hunters Association wanted to put in. It says, subject to ORS 496-690, this section does not apply to the unintentional taking of killing of wildlife incident to otherwise lawful activity. And when you are out there hunting, sometimes things happen. There's two deer, there's two elk. A bullet goes through and hits something that you didn't intend to hit. So we want to make sure that those activities are not caught up in this, and we're able to get that in the bill for them. It really is an attempt to get at the serious multiple violations. As it is now, these things can be prosecuted, I believe, as a violation or a misdemeanor, which means as a misdemeanor is $6,250 and 1 year in jail if they decide to go that way. Section 4 that was in the original bill that called for a 6 months incarceration, because of the violation thing, you can't have a jail sentence without a jury trial. Therefore, the entire Section 4 came out. I think this has been definitely a bill that was negotiated as a result of a bill from 2015 that made took almost all the discretion of the courts away. We're not doing that until the third conviction within 10 years. That was a negotiated thing with Representative Helm and the Oregon Hunters Association and others that were involved in it. And I'll stop there and let Representative Helm have his say.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Ken Helm, representing House District 34. The only thing that I would add is to make sure that you know what a broad coalition of groups and persons were involved in the building of this bill. We have groups such as Oregon Wild Sierra Club, representing environmental and conservation interests, and we on the other end of the spectrum, we have Oregon Hunters Association. And I felt really good about working with this broad group of stakeholders, and it turns out we all have an interest in preserving our fish and wildlife species in this state for various reasons, and I'm happy that the group was able to come together and bring you this bill. Otherwise, Representative Krieger has covered all the salient points, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. Well, thank you both for your work on this and for your testimony, too. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question.
Go ahead, Senator Ferriola.
Perhaps for Representative Krieger, based on your extensive experience as a law enforcement officer in game protection, what about this issue of redesignating the gray wolf and adding that to the list of game mammals? So does that mean at some point in time we will manage the gray wolf as a game mammal?
It actually is going to be a game animal from the work that they did at the Department of Fish and Wildlife when they delisted it. And one of the things that I'm trying to think of the representative's names from over on the east side there with you, our new one.
Representative Barreto?
Barreto, thank you.
Yes.
He even agreed that it should go in the list with game animals because the department and the state of Oregon had tens of thousands of dollars into that management plan, and being able to track those animals and understand and manage them, that they are valuable to the state. There was some concern about the value of black bear and cougar. I even had some concern there because I've had about $400,000 of damage in my tree farm from bears. But at the same time, they are game animals, and we want to get them fairly close to the same point, and it was one of the points that was negotiated.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Okay, it looks like you've answered them all. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
And we do have several other people signed up. I'll call them in groups, and I will let you know that we don't need a great deal of testimony here because we do have a lot of bills to get through today, but so just briefly tell us what you have to say, and we'll move on. So I'll call Joe Rolander, Al Elkins, and Brian Posowitz, if the three of you would like to come forward. And whoever wants to go first, just introduce yourself and get started.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association.
Okay.
Previous speakers talked about the work group that we were a part of that included a membership from the Audubon Society, Humane Society of the United States, various fishing groups and hunting groups. We worked diligently on this concept for 3 or 4 months. Our discussion centered around stronger penalties to deter the illegal taking of wildlife and the what's going on in the international scene in relation to those efforts. The previous speaker talked about our amendment to the bill. We support the bill. That concludes my testimony.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Brian Posowitz. I also promise to be very brief. I'm here today on behalf of an organization called Humane Oregon. We were formed in 2014 to help advocate for animal welfare in Oregon's political process and elections. We support House Bill 4046 as amended. We think it would encourage respect for the wildlife laws by increasing the penalties for breaking them. We also participated in the work group in 2015 that led to a bill that didn't quite get out of committee that year. We think this bill represents some reasonable changes to that bill to make it more palatable. So thank you for getting this bill on your schedule and for the opportunity to comment.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I'm representing today McKinsey River Guides Association and the Oregon Outdoor Council. My clients have been very concerned over the years about poaching of game animals and fish. That's really stealing the wildlife that belongs to the people of Oregon. My clients support this bill, and I urge your passage. Thank you.
Great. Thank you all three for your testimony. Did we have any questions? Okay. I don't see any questions for you, so thanks again.
Thank you.
And next I'll call Tom Wolf and Bob Breeze, if the two of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Bob Breeze, representing the Association of Northwest Steelheaders and the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association. We, too, just wish to express our strong support for House Bill 4046. Thank you very much.
Chair Rosenbaum, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout and Limit. I've sent in written testimony, so I'll be very brief. We support this bill and the amendments. One of the problems facing us now, as far as the fish issues, is even though there's the white sturgeon population in the Columbia, is numbers are pretty good. The number of spawners is down in an alarming manner, and part of the reason is there's organized groups going out and harvesting the spawners and taking their eggs or caviar and selling it on the market. We think this bill is a good way to deal with that, and we support it. Thank you.
Great. Any questions, members? Okay, I don't see any questions for you. Thanks again. And that completes our sign-up sheet on House Bill 4046. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4046B, open a work session on House Bill 4046B. Senator Ferrioli?
Madam Chair, I have a reservation about the bill, which I'll put on the record. But I am not the right person to ask to move the bill.
Okay. Senator Beyer, would you be willing to make a motion?
You want me to make a motion? Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4046 to the floor with a due pass. I'll speak to my motion.
Okay. Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 4046B to the floor with a due pass recommendation to your motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was involved in the original work group with this. I do have a few reservations about it, but it is the product of a work group, so therefore I will be supportive of it.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Ferrioli, did you have a comment?
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. Most of the increases I support, certainly the fee, the fines for poaching elk, gray wolf, black bear, cougar, moose, they're doubled in some cases up to $50,000. Certainly that'll have a deterrent effect. Sage grouse from 20 to 1,000 seems a bit excessive. Oversized sturgeon, that could be a quarter of an inch, from $1,000 to $5,000. And other fees doubling or tripling seems a little excessive. I understand the intent. I'll vote no in committee and reserve the right to contemplate this further before we go to the floor.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Further discussion? Okay, Eamon, would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Excused.
Vice Chair Farrelly?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. And the motion carries, and it looks like Senator Roblin is the chief sponsor, so we'll ask him to be our carrier on the floor, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4046. And
you decided to join us.
I did. I've heard this is for the fun end.
She's doing double duty today. So should we go back up to the first one?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Okay, so next we'll move to our first bill on the agenda and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1584. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1584 changes water management and conservation plan approval condition for extension of time to construct works or perfect right for municipal water use, declares emergency effective upon passage. You do have a -3 amendment, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The -3 amendment changes definition of undeveloped portion of permit to mean portion of water right permit that is the difference between maximum rate or duty of water authorized by permit and maximum rate or duty of water diverted for beneficial use as of the later of December 11th, 2010, rather than the 2013 that is in the original measure, Madam Chair. You have a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the -3 amendment.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And we have several people signed up on this, so we'll start by calling Tracy Rattan and Mark Landauer, if the two of you would like to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Tracy Rutten with League of Oregon Cities. I was going to start by thanking Senator Boquist for his introduction of this bill.
He'll be back momentarily.
He will be back, I'm sure. So the League appreciates the opportunity to support Senate Bill 1584. This bill is critical legislation for approximately 16 Oregon communities who, as a result of a 2013 court decision, are facing required reductions of water supply that they may have been using for as many as 20 years or more. This bill is important as it not only protects drinking water for people, but water that is used for public health, public safety, and economic development purposes. I really want to emphasize that these communities have been put in this rather unfortunate situation of having their water supply retroactively conditioned or curtailed due to circumstances that were very much out of their control. I want to briefly refresh the committee on the background of this issue. In respect of time, I want to make sure I can try and do this as quickly as I possibly can. Oregon water law typically allows 5 years for water users to put all of the water under their permit to full beneficial use, to essentially demonstrate they're able to use all the water that has been permitted to them. However, historically, prior to 1999, municipalities have had as long as they really have needed to develop the water under their permits. This being obviously, I think, critical for population growth and supporting future economic development and meeting the current and long-term public health and safety needs of communities. Prior to 1998, the Water Resource Department would provide municipalities with what are known as extensions of time. So how they did this is they would send postcards out to communities every 5 years, kind of checking in and saying, are you still planning to use all of this water in your permit? And the community would send that back to them. However, in the late 1990s, the Department of Justice indicated to the Water Resource Department that they thought there was a more efficient way to do this. As a result, the department put all of those postcard extensions on administrative hold and started a process of rulemaking to figure out a better way to do it. In the meantime, as these rules were still being developed, in 2003, there was a court case, which was Water Watch versus Coos Bay North Bend. In that case, the court, in that decision, there was a challenge of the amount of time that a municipality had to develop their water under a permit. And the court indicated in their decision, Court of Appeals, that while it makes a lot of sense for a municipality to have more time than, let's say, 5 years like another agricultural type of user, that there was not a statute that supported additional time beyond 5 years. In light of that decision, in which Oregon communities would have only a 5-year water supply going forward, the League and special districts introduced or worked on legislation during the 2005 session. That legislation did pass in the form of House Bill 3038. And what it did was provide municipalities with 20 years to develop the water under their permits. And if they needed more time, they would need to file for an extension. in order to receive that extension of time, they would show that they had been doing due diligence to develop that water and adopt a water management conservation plan. However, there were specific provisions that applied to those pre-1998 permits that had been put on hold. So we're back to those postcard permits that still haven't been dealt with as of this time. And what it said was that for an extension that was filed after 2005, so essentially the passage of that bill, for those pre-1998 permits, that the undeveloped portion of that permit would be conditioned for the persistence of listed fish species. A mouthful. What these conditions typically result in is about a 20 to 30% reduction in the water available for that undeveloped portion of the permit. In 2006, the department adopted administrative rules and began to process all of these permits that they now had a pretty significant backlog of. In the rules that they had adopted, in the documentation that we received from them, they had indicated that the application of that that undeveloped portion was to be on a going forward basis. So essentially, they would call a municipality and say, "Tell us how much water you've used to date and how much you have not used," and it would be that unused amount that would be conditioned. This changed in 2013. There was another court case dealing with a pretty specific issue, but it had a pretty broad impact. And what that impact was that the court said to the Water Resource Department, essentially, you've been doing this wrong. The court said, we think that what the law meant was that you should go back to the last approved extension of time. So for these pre-1998 permit holders, that means the last postcard that they had. For one city in particular, it's back to 1993. So rather than the department calling and saying, how much water have you used to date, it's how much water were you using in 1993. So I'll turn it over in a little while to Mark to talk about the impact to the communities. But I want to make sure I note that this water that our communities would have to curtail or bypass is actually not protected under in-stream water, right? So essentially, theoretically, a community could bypass this water because they've received retroactive conditioning, require them to do so and bypass the water. And a community that's just downstream from them with maybe a junior water right can now take that water. So it's not protected for fish. So I just want to make sure that's clear. And also, I want to talk briefly about the Dosh 3 amendment that changes the state to 2010. I will say it might not be the perfect solution, but I think it's a reasonable solution. I think it's a good compromise. I think it significantly addresses the concerns that a lot of these communities have. And when we're talking about concerns that Mark will get into, millions of dollars of investment in water treatment plants or distribution systems with assumptions that they should have rightfully had that they would have that water available to them. So happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents about 950 special districts across the state of Oregon, providing single services throughout the state like fire, parks and rec, and surprisingly, water. Municipal water. Our association represents about 49 municipal water providers, and I want to make a quick correction to Ms. Rutten's testimony. I heard her say that this bill affects 16 communities, and I want to make sure that it's approximately 60, and you have a list of those communities before you. So what's the result of the 2013 Oregon Court of Appeals decision? Well, for those communities who had extensions processed prior to the court's decision, they are okay, as they had the benefit of how the rules were being implemented by the Water Resources Department. So there was, in effect, no retroactive application of fish persistence to those communities. For those who did, as Ms. Rutten pointed out, were placed on administrative hold, or if they were in litigation and those permits had not been processed, the court's ruling essentially means, as she mentioned, that the fish conditions would be applied to those municipal water suppliers back to their last approved extension. Ms. Rutten mentioned 1993. I'll tell you the city that is stuck with having to go back to 1993, and that would be the city of Philomath. It's important to understand that we are not talking about a lot of water here. Let me give you a sense for the scale. According to the Oregon Integrated Water Resources Strategy, all water users in Oregon divert about 9 million acre-feet of water each year out of stream. That's from a total yield of 91 million acre-feet a year in the state of Oregon. The water that's not diverted, a portion of that water, or approximately 19 million acre-feet, is protected under 1,400 in-stream water rights that are held in trust by the state of Oregon. Municipal water use accounts for approximately 6% of that 9 million acre-feet of water that I mentioned previously. This is for all of Oregon's municipal suppliers who hold approximately 1,600 permits. So again, we're talking 60 of those 1,600. And again, we're talking a very small percentage of those 60 permits, the amount of water that is being contested here. Some of these communities have invested literally millions of dollars. Let me give you three examples. The city of Hood River has invested over $40 million in their water system. The special district called Oak Lodge Water District has invested $28 million and would have retroactive application. And Senator Boquist's community of Carlton has invested some $2.3 million in their water system. And mind you, needless to say, it's a very small community. $2.3 million is a great sum of money. Communities must be able to rely on the Oregon Water Resources Department to provide them with accurate information as to how to properly develop their water. But the court's decision completely changed how everyone understood the conditions to be applied. Let me make a few other points. This bill in no way reduces conservation efforts that are being undertaken by communities. Conservation, this water is treated water. It is valuable water. The community has spent money to treat it. We have no interest in leaking pipes. We have no interest in wastefully using it. It is valuable water, and our communities very much rely on it. Nor does this bill in any way eliminate the requirement that water suppliers undertake water management and conservation plans. Nor does the bill overturn a compromise in 2005. The reason it's not overturning a compromise was because everybody understood that those conditions were to be applied going forward. The Oregon Water Resources Department promulgated regulations to do it that way. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife did it that way. Municipal suppliers understood it to work that way. Finally, it's important to note that if we don't pass this bill, the Water Resources Department will need to process these permits with the retroactive conditions. Once that happens, they are final orders and it cannot be undone. Finally, the Dash 3 Amendment. As Ms. Rutten mentioned, it takes it back to December 11, 2010. That will provide a great deal of relief for many of these communities, but it will still have some retroactive applicability because those communities that developed water after December 11, 2010 will still have a retroactive application, but we feel that a 2010 date is a fair and reasonable time period, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Okay, thank you both. Do we have any questions? Yes, sure. Senator Farrioli, go ahead.
You know, this is an issue that's vexed people a couple of legislative sessions now. We thought we had her cleaned up and fixed last time, but I think we ran out of time. But in this instance, there's an illogic here that's sort of institutionalized. If a city went and got a well field in response to needing more water and applied for a water right, as it must, to use that municipal water, and was certified for more than it had an immediate use for, there would have been created this difference between what they're using and what they've been certified for. Rightfully, any unused portion there, particularly on surface water, should go back for be considered for other uses. The persistence of fish question has to do with conservation and Oregon Salmon Plan and all of our efforts to restore salmonids. But in the logic here is that a municipality with a well field may be putting water into a pipe that it gets from the ground, running it through the municipal system, and then treating it and returning it back to the surface water. The question of persistence of fish doesn't seem to apply to me when all that water's been in a pipe until the city actually used it and then let it go. Back into water courses after it's been treated. So cities are being asked to conserve a portion of water that's in the pipe from the well field for the persistence of fish. Where are the fish? So, the illogic for me is we ought to be able to solve this problem with the Dash 3 amendments and the bill. We ought to be able to put a peg in the ground in 2010, which is a compromise because some of these water rights go back decades earlier. At the end of the day, this is a solution, or at least a decision by the courts that are driven by appeals, maybe motivated by the right ideal, but in fact just confounding the whole expectations that municipal water rights need to be permitted, populations need to be served, the water system needs to be safe and reliable, persistence of fish and pipes is absolutely illogical. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Brief question.
Yes.
Just
go ahead.
Very brief question. In Senate Bill 971, which was before this committee, I guess a year ago, I don't know, whatever the last session was, okay. And in that, it was presented to all the members, the same members of this committee that sit here today. During that bill, what was presented as a compromise bill that this committee did not act upon had a date of 2005. And we were told in Senate Bill 971 that would correct the challenges for some 46 water districts except for six. So we're just leaving six out in the cold. I, of course, for the record, offered to throw at least one of those under the bus. And I had an amendment to throw one of those under the bus, so we'd only fix five more. But we proposed in that, or it was discussed in open hearing on 971, that we move the date to 2013. So by moving the date to 2010, all we're doing is adding six additional water districts to the original compromise that was purported to be between all groups in 971. Is that not correct?
Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Boquist, that is to the best of my ability. My understanding as well, it's hard. We have been trying to communicate with communities. This is very complicated. But for those most, I think, significant, we know there's a big impact, yes.
Right. So all what we're really doing is trying to add five or six more water districts to the compromise before. Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And next we'll call John DeVoe, Lisa Brown, and Christy Split, if the three of you would like to come forward.
Sorry, your amendment didn't go through.
Which one?
Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Nice to be here. John DeVoe, Executive Director of Water Watch of Oregon. I'm with Lisa Brown, Policy Attorney at Water Watch of Oregon. We're going to kind of tag team it with your indulgence here. That was interesting testimony. Heard quite a bit there. A fair amount of it I would disagree with. I will say that this is the type of matter that is, I think, should be obvious to everyone in the room, quite complicated and has a long history. And, this is a relatively, despite the effort to suggest this only applies to five or six entities here as opposed to the 971 compromise a year ago, this is a major revision of Oregon water law that has big effects on listed fish throughout the state and state-sensitive species in the watersheds where they're found, where municipalities are developing these dormant and previously undeveloped water rights. This change that's being proposed will also, contrary to what you've been told, reduce the amount of water conservation and management planning that is undertaken in the state. I was on the Water Resources Department's website this morning looking at their February 16th report on drought in the state. 34% of Oregon is still in severe drought. The state is now out of extreme drought all across the state, but 34%, and most of that is in southeastern Oregon, is still in severe drought. Many reservoirs in eastern Oregon are not filling or filling very slowly at this time. We are not out of the woods by any means when it comes to water in the state. And I would just suggest that rolling back a water conservation and management planning requirement for municipalities is out of step with what's happening nationally, and it's out of step with what's happening across the state in many cities. Our understanding is that water management and conservation planning for these entities has been quite helpful in terms of helping them extend their supplies, in terms of helping them identify what their water portfolios are, in terms of helping them understand what they need to do to plan for the future. And so I would suggest to the committee, Water Watch would suggest to the committee, and by the way, we have many, many, many supporters throughout Oregon. And I would point out we have more supporters in Congressman Walden's congressional district than any other congressional district in the state. This is important to many people around Oregon, and it is a substantial rollback of water conservation and planning in the state. So I want to make that very clear, that we are in a time of drought and a changing climate, and we are in a time when some writers have called this the sixth extinction. Elizabeth Colbert, maybe some of you have read the book. This is a time when we are on the verge of seeing salmon stocks wink out in various watersheds in our state. And it's extremely important that as we develop water, we do so in a way that is sensitive to the needs of cities, but also is sensitive to the needs of fish and our streams. I guess I'd like to conclude this piece by suggesting that this is an example of a bill that needs more discussion than has been had this session and deserves more process than has been devoted to it in these last few hours of the last couple days. So I would suggest that the process has not been great on the bill, and I think that is in contrast to the 971 compromise that we saw last session, where there was a robust negotiation over quite a bit of time that resulted in what we thought was a compromise on the bill that was brought to this committee and then was undermined by a few interests at the end of the session. I guess I would point out that that is not the first time that there has been a compromise in this area. House Bill 3038 was mentioned previously. That bill was compromise legislation in 2005. And some of the proponents for the bill here today were involved in that compromise at that time. Some of the proponents for the bill today are the same parties that were involved in the compromise a year ago on 971. I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Brown to explain some of the history involved here and some of the impacts.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Lisa Brown with Water Watch of Oregon. I just want to put this bill into context. I mean, what we are talking about here is old municipal water rights that were issued without a fish review, and that when they're developed now, they pose a significant impact to imperiled fish in our watersheds. Some have described these dormant rights as ticking time bombs. And so while Mark Landauer, I think, highlighted that municipal water use is a lower amount of water use in the state as compared to agriculture, on a lot of rivers where these water rights sit, they pose serious impacts to fish. And in the House Bill 3038 compromise in 2005, the cities gained the right to develop these old water rights. That's what they secured in the bill in exchange for the requirement that the water rights be conditioned. And I think to suggest that the interpretation of the law made by the Court of Appeals was something that nobody understood in 2005 is incorrect. That was always what the Court of Appeals affirmed was always our understanding of the law. So to suggest that that was just a surprise, I think, is inaccurate. And the work that was done on Senate Bill 971 last session, which entailed hours and really weeks, hours and hours of work. And those negotiations, I think, were done in good faith. We did arrive at 2005 as the date at which the developed versus undeveloped portion of a water right would be delineated. Nobody got everything they wanted, but I think it did address the city's concerns over retroactive conditioning. And unfortunately, certain interests prevented that bill from passing last session. So what this bill does, I think, is just throws away all the work that we did last session and moves the date to 2005, which does in fact exempt some cities from water management conservation planning. And it will have impacts to our rivers and fish. So we urge the committee to oppose the bill.
If I could just finish up with a bit on the investment side of things. There was mentioned that Carlton has invested $2.3 million in upgrading its water system. I would note that Carlton historically had a 39% leak rate in its water system. And the only right here that we're talking about being conditioned for Carlton is on Panther Creek. It's a very small water right. Carlton has done what was recommended to it in its water management and conservation plan. It has gone out and diversified its water supply sources by looking at interties with McMinnville, by looking at water from the Willamette through Yamhill County and other sources. This is how water management and conservation planning works and why it's helpful for cities. But I would point out that I think none of that $2.3 million, to my knowledge, was spent on addressing the leak rate in the city. That's my understanding of it, and it's illogical to us that a city would have a leak rate of that magnitude but would not address it, and at the same time claim that it can't spare a drop for the threatened steelhead run in Panther Creek. Carlton also has a problem with its reservoir, which is that it built the reservoir in a valley that has extreme landslide activity. There have been documented many landslides in there, and so its reservoir has a siltation problem. And these are issues it needs to address, but all these issues should not be put on the backs of the threatened fish in the watershed. So I would just like to close with that. Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Split, and I'm here representing the Oregon Conservation Network today. We're a coalition of 41 organizations from around the state that work on a whole host of issues. Both last year and this year, this same concept was brought to our coalition by Water Watch and other groups as a major threat to a healthy Oregon. By consensus vote, all 42 organizations agreed that indeed this issue ranks that high to our community. We're both surprised and disappointed, frankly, to see this bill come up at such a late date after we did so much work to get all of the Oregon Conservation Network to a neutral position on the bill at the end of the last legislative session to kind of start over, go back to the beginning, and then maybe take a few years off with an amendment that just came out as well. Just doesn't strike us as the way that we should be working together. We were happy to get together and work for hours and hours and hours on a potential solution to the problem, and I think Water Watch and others would be willing to do that again if given the opportunity. So just want to register, one, that this is a major threat for the Oregon Conservation Network, one of three still alive here at the end of session and seemingly moving, and also just reiterate that, you know, we're here and interested in working with diverse groups to arrive at common ground and find solutions. When we're given the opportunity to, we're glad to, and when we're not, it is really frustrating to us, and that's the position that we're in once again. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel?
I better not.
Okay. Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so thanks for your testimony. And next I'll call Raquel Rancier, Doug Riggs, and Tom Wolf. Since we actually just have one more person, maybe I'll also call Bob Breeze, and you can just play musical chairs. Or pull up another chair.
Chair Rosenbaum,
committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I've already sent in written testimony, and I see you have a lot of issues still on your docket, so I'll be very brief. Trout Unlimited opposes this bill also, and my reasons are listed in my testimony. One of the problems here is you're trying to solve. I see it's a big issue. You're trying to solve it in a very brief time. I would suggest you come back in the 2017 session and work on this and bring all the parties together. And I would like to suggest that Trout Unlimited be part of that. We have water policy people in our state that would be happy to help work out a compromise that could make all parties happy. And that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Bob Reese, representing the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, as well as the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, collectively representing over 10,000 sport anglers in the state of Oregon. We adamantly oppose Senate Bill 1584, which effectively rolls back fish review and water conservation requirements for certain municipal water permits. Representing both the social and the economic voice in this conversation, this is a bad bill that compromises a multi-million dollar industry here in the state of Oregon, the sport fishing industry. Setting aside the possibility of dewatering key salmon and steelhead streams such as the Kilchis River in Tillamook, Oregon, where I'm from, any reduction in flows puts into jeopardy over-summering salmonids that are already in a depressed state, if not listed on the federal ESA. Salmon kills associated with low, warm flows last year were the cause of massive river closures for sport fishing. And just last year, when hundreds of thousands of salmon died in the lethal waters of the Columbia, in the Willamette and the Clackamas Rivers, as well as likely other watersheds throughout the state. My drinking water comes from the Kilchis River in Bay City. And I think if the residents of Tillamook County knew that this bill had any legs here in the legislature, that the entire room would probably be filled with upset citizens that this bill was being considered. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs. Also for the record, I was one of the people who was here in the building, participated in the dozens and dozens of meetings and work groups on this issue in 2005, so I want to bring some history to this issue. First of all, I want to respond to a couple of the issues that were raised earlier. In my mind, this is not a complicated issue at all. This is a very simple issue. We were all at the table in 2005. My group, the Central Oregon Cities Organization, had concerns about the persistence of fish language. We believe that existing statutes and rules properly covered and protected fish, and we all protect stream flows. The Deschutes Basin, as the senator from Central Oregon knows, has been top in our agenda to keep stream flows, especially in Middle Deschutes, high. But we resisted the persistence of fish issue. At the end of the day, it was adopted. But only after we were all given assurances that the provisions that would be developed by the department would be prospective and not retrospective. And that's exactly what we're talking about today. We have an appeals court that went back in time and changed the intent of this legislature and the people who were at the table at the time, which was the rules were supposed to be from this point forward, from the point that the rules were enacted forward, not retroactive. So all this bill does is reinstate the interpretation that I certainly heard, and I know because I asked that question probably several dozen times in the meetings. Second of all, I think this really illustrates a need to reiterate what the legislative process is. The legislature passed this bill. They developed the bill. They had hearings on the bill. We all testified on the bill, and we passed the bill. And so I think we need to reiterate to the court what the intent was. Finally, I want to respond to the last questions that were raised here a moment ago. No one in this basin, in my basin, no one any place in the state wants to dewater a river. No one wants to see salmon go extinct or fish go away. There's no one in any of my cities, on my city councils, members of my community, who want to see any of that happen. And there are plenty of existing provisions in state law, both prior to the adoption of these rules and post the adoption of these rules, that are going to make sure that we protect salmon. I could go on for hours about all the efforts that we've made in the Deschutes Basin, which has quadrupled the flow in the middle of the Deschutes in the last 10 years as a result of our efforts. So nothing in this bill will have any impact on that. Every single local city working on a permit that was prior to 2010 has fish protections in those permits. Those do not go away. They are not changed, and they remain in place to protect fish, protect flows, and protect the environment. So I hope that we can adopt the Dash 3s today, reiterate the intent that this should be prospective and not retrospective, and pass the bill on to the floor. Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Raquel Ransier with the Oregon Water Resources Department. I came here today in case there was questions, or really I was going to provide a little bit of information about the history around how we had conducted rulemakings and how this whole process had started back in the 90s and on through to today. A lot of that has been covered, and so I think I'll leave it at that, noting that the department had over time, you know, in the 90s, we had put permits on hold. There was lots of discussions around municipal extensions. And then when we did begin to start processing those in 2006, we had some municipalities had continued to develop water through that point and continued. And we had looked at the date at which their extension, what water had been developed to that extension. So I'm happy to provide more information. I know you're under tight timelines, so I'll leave it at that and take any questions if necessary.
Okay. Do we have any questions for these witnesses?
No, ma'am. I just want to thank at least the three gentlemen for sticking to their guns, whether they're for or against it, from 971 to this one and not changing their position. So I do appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. And that completes the sign-up sheet on Senate Bill 1584. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1584 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1584. Senator Farioli, did you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 3 amendments to 1584.
Okay, Senator Farioli has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1584. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? The chair objects, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move Senate Bill 1584 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 1584 as amended by the Dash 3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, yes. To correct the record. During the agreement that agreed before it came to this committee in SB 971, in the last session, two of the principal individuals were Senator Hansel and Senator Roblin. And in the spirit of leaving the building as quickly as possible, they have conveyed they're unable to be here, but they both support the Dash 3 amendments. The only difference between the Dash 3 amendments and the, quote, compromise that was discussed in 971 are exactly four letters. That changes the date from 2005 to 2010. For the record, Madam Chair, the Carlton Water District does, in fact, rely on Panther Creek for its primary source of water, and it is still short $10 million to complete sealing those leaks. The last thing, Madam Chair, is for the record, is I do have the testimony from all of the previous bills pulled out, including House Bill 3038, and I quote from Water Watch testimony on that day, while some former legislators may be appropriate to serve the end, House Bill 3038 goes too far. So I'm not sure how people are on and off. So therefore, I would simply ask the committee at this point, we need to move on. We need to protect all the water districts, not leave four or five of them out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Senator Boquist. Further discussion from committee members? I'll just say that I unfortunately am not going to be able to support this bill today. I think it is too bad that the bill is starting this late in the session because it is complicated and probably should have started in a committee that had more time to deal with the issue. I know it did have a lot of work in 2015 and did seem like for a while there was a compromise version that did fall apart, as a number of people have said, just virtually at the end of the 2015 session. So obviously there is not a compromise today, and I don't know what to say other than that I think the bill needs more work. So, Amen, would you call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
No. And the bill carries. And Senator Boquist, would you be our carrier on the floor? Okay, Senator Boquist will carry the bill on the floor, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1584. And good. Okay, do we need a public hearing? Yeah. Okay, so
ma'am.
Yes.
Would you entertain a motion to
I think I know what you're going to say. Yes.
Suspend the rules and go back to 4046 for the purpose of allowing the good senator to my left to vote on it.
Yes.
It will not change the outcome of the bill, both physically and
Okay, so the chair asks for unanimous consent to allow Senator Burdick to vote on House Bill 4046 without objection.
And Madam Chair, that is pursuant to the fact that the good senator making the motion was on the prevailing side. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So the rules are suspended. Senator Burdick, how do you vote?
I'm on the prevailing side, and I vote aye.
She votes aye. So we
also, Madam Chair, on the extreme left.
Depending on
from a certain angle.
Right. Or the extreme right, if you're in the audience. Okay, so we'll close the work session on House Bill 4046 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4126. Erin.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4126 permits cities outside Metro to complete evaluations and amendments of urban growth boundaries under statutes and administrative rules in effect on June 30th, 2013, if city has met certain requirements prior to January 1, 2016. This measure does have an emergency clause. It comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And there are two people signed up to testify on this, so I'll call them both, Erin Doyle and Dan Eisenbeiss, if the two of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. And whoever wants to go first, just go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. House Bill 4126 is a small technical clarification that addresses an issue that relates to legislation that this body passed in 2013 unanimously. It creates clarity in the urban growth boundary review process. In 2013, House Bill 2254 made significant changes to the process cities use to evaluate which lands should come into the UGB. The bill had support of stakeholders across the spectrum on land use policy, from Thousand Friends to home builders to the cities. And the bill required that the Land Conservation and Development Commission develop rules that became operative on January 1st, 2016. At the time the bill passed in 2013, there were a few cities that were in the process of trying to finalize their urban growth boundary expansions, and we had expected in the intervening 2.5 years that they would be done. But like many land use processes, it took longer than we expected for these communities, and some of them are still trying to complete the process. As a result, when the new rules became operative on January 1st, there is a possibility that they could be challenged, that they had to meet the requirements of the new rules. This is a result in part of unclear authority for LCDC to grandfather the pending UGB processes to the old rules that were in place in 2013. House Bill 4126 now provides provides express authority that decision to grandfather ongoing processes to the rules in place when they started was the intention of the legislature and the stakeholders. Without this bill, it is possible that the unclear authority could be used as a means to challenge a UGB decision, thus further slowing down, adding costs, and confusing the public as to what was intended. For most of these communities, they're coming to the end of their UG process, and it's controversial enough without adding an additional ground for challenge. We've narrowly tailored this bill to provide clarity for the limited number of cities that began their process before the new rules became operative. And if you look on OLIS, you can see letters from a number of different cities that would potentially be impacted who support this technical fix. On behalf of the League and the cities impacted by these rules, we thank you for consideration of this bill during this session, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, here to speak in support of House Bill 4126 today. I believe Ms. Doyle summarized the issue well. I would just note that this bill provides clarity regarding the ability for in-progress cities to opt whether to complete their UGB evaluation and amendment process under the old rules or under the new rules. Part of that rulemaking effort, as directed by legislation in 2013, was to create a optional simplified urban growth boundary amendment process that reduces complexity, time, and costs for cities outside of the Portland metro area. Those rules took effect on January 1st of this year. Aaron alluded to, the commission did adopt a similar provision in the rules that were adopted. This bill would simply remove any potential ambiguity about the authority for that provision. And with that, I'm happy to address any questions.
Okay. Do we have any questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you. It looks like you answered them all. So thanks again for your testimony. That completes our sign-up, and I will close our public hearing on House Bill 4126, open a work session on House Bill 4126. Vice Chair Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the House Bill 4126. To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli moves House Bill 4126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And Senator Beyer, you are a sponsor, so we'll ask you to carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 4126. Okay, so next we'll open a public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 208. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, HCR 208 recognizes the 75th anniversary of American Tree Farm System and commends groups interested in wise management of forest resources. It comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. And we have two people signed up to testify, so I'll call them both, Dick Cortez and Mike Barsotti, if the two of you would like to come forward. And welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Whoever wants to go first.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum, committee members. I'm Dick Corder. I'm a tree farmer in Columbia County. Past president of Association of Consulting Foresters of America, and past board chair on the Oregon Tree Farm System. I submitted some written testimony, and I'll defer to that, but I'd like to at least highlight a few points for you. The American Tree Farm System really sort of started in Portland. Nearly all the committee meetings, organizational meetings, were held in the old Portland Hotel, which is now Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland. The Oregon was one of the first five states that signed up for the program, and there have been tens and tens of thousands of foresters across the United States that have volunteered to make the program work. Just want to bring to your attention that there's a number of prominent individuals across the United States that are tree farmers. This is just to name a few. The actress Andy McDowell is one. My good friend, the Rolling Stones musician Chuck Clavel, is another. President Jimmy Carter is another. Actor Andy Griffith. And Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. And there's a number of others as well. Also want to bring to your attention the four Oregon families that have been recognized as National Tree Farmers of the Year. And that's Bert and Betty Udell of Linn County, Representative Wayne and Colleen Krieger of Curry County, Ron and Barbara Bentz of Linn County, and the former Senator Bob Kintai and Margaret Kintai of Lane County. With that, I think I'll just leave it at that. Answer any questions if you have. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Mike Barsotti. I'm a Linn County tree farmer and a certified tree farmer and a member of the past chair of the Oregon tree farm system. I think we all agree that Oregon appreciates its forest, and these white diamonds, these green and white diamonds you see on rural fence posts and gates represent that those lands behind those signs are sustainably managed and addressing a lot of the values that Oregons have for their forest. Senator Wyden last week at the University of Oregon's a workshop on a roundtable on forest products made a statement that that if we were thinking of an area where Oregon would really like to be decades ahead, a sustainable forest product sector would be right at the top of that list. The tree farm is working diligently to make that happen with family forest landowners. This morning, I'd like to, this afternoon, I'd like to talk, highlight three areas where I think tree farm is important to Oregon. One is that it's a certified forest system. One, it uses a voluntary approach. And third, the importance of family forest lands, forest family lands in the state. So the American tree farm system, as Dick mentioned, started in 1941. It's the oldest forest certification system in the country. It has a set of internationally recognized standards, and it pays third-party auditors to verify that the landowners are following those standards. These standards address the issues in our Forest Practices Act and plus some additional ones. Oregon Tree Farm is a voluntary system. It's voluntary both for those that help the landowners and the landowners who wish to participate. The Oregon Board of Forestry's Forestry Program for Oregon, one of its vision statements is has landowners voluntarily investing in the management of their properties. The foresters that help landowners come from all sectors, from consultants, industrial foresters, public foresters, and us retired volunteers. It has no cost to the landowner, and it's a very inefficient, a very efficient system. The third area I'd like to cover is that these four family forest lands are important. They make up 44% of Oregon's private forest lands, and approximately 20% of these 800,000 acres is in the tree farm system currently. Our family forest lands are often the closest to our towns and city, and therefore they're the most visible, the ones that we often see from our towns and cities without looking at our green hillsides. These lands are also lower in the watersheds, and therefore a higher percentage of our critical fish streams travel through them. So for these reasons, I ask that you support this concurrent resolution 208 that recognizes Tree Farm and its 75 years of promoting healthy, sustainable forests.
Great. Well, thank you both for your testimony. That's quite a milestone. So, any questions for these folks? Okay. Well, thank you again for your testimony. And that completes our sign-up sheet. So I will close the public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 208 and open a work session on HCR 208. Vice Chair Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 208 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved HCR 208 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. And Senator Ferrioli, did you want to carry this on the floor?
It's an honor, Madam Chair. Thank
great.
You.
Okay, well,
trees are awesome.
There's no trees in your district.
Yes, there is. There's beautiful pine trees.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the trees in my district are sick, bug infested, and dying because of drought and mismanagement. That is not true. of the lands managed by our tree farmers in the state throughout the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on HCR 208 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4134. Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4134A requires lobbyists to register with Oregon Government Ethics Commission within 3 business days after exceeding specified requirements. It requires that not later than 10 days after lobbyists file statement with Government Ethics Commission, official authorization to lobby must be signed. Lobbyists may unilaterally withdraw the registration not more than one time per calendar year if done within 10 calendar days of filing and before official authorization to lobby has been signed. Lobbyists must notify the commission within 3 business days if they cease representation of person for whom they are registered to lobby for. Requires commission to make lobbyist registration and lobbyist registration updates publicly available on the internet within 1 calendar day of receiving information. It applies to registrations made or revisions made on or after January 1, 2017. There is an emergency clause on the measure, Madam Chair. It comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact, and it comes to you with 58 aye votes from your House.
Okay, thank you very much, Erin, and welcome to Gina Zedlick.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gina Zedlick. I'm Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Brown. Thank you for having me today. I'm here to testify on House Bill 4134 related to lobbying. As you know, lobbying is a citizen's ability to engage with decision makers in order to affect public policy decisions. Lobbying has become an accepted aspect of policymaking. And now more than ever, the public wants and deserves the utmost transparency in these interactions. Under current law, lobbyists must report any change in their clientele to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission within 10 days. However, during a legislative session in particular, a lobbyist's clients may change quickly. Moreover, although lobbyists and whom they represent is considered public information, the public has no up-to-date, easy way to access this information. House Bill 4134 shines a spotlight on lobbying activity in Oregon. This bill requires quicker reporting of changes to a lobbyist's clients and mandates that the Oregon Government Ethics Commission also make that information easily and quickly available online. Specifically, it requires reporting within 3 business days when a lobbyist either commences or ceases representation of a client. It directs the Ethics Commission to make that information easily accessible online within 1 calendar day. And finally, it makes other adjustments to the law that recognize the Ethics Commission's new electronic reporting system. I'd like to point out that working closely with the Capitol Club on amendments to this bill on the House, as well as the Ethics Commission, which has recently embraced a new online system for ethics reporting, have shaped this bill in its current form. And I'd like to thank both for their work on this bill. I also appreciate an analogy that Representative Williams used on the House floor regarding this bill. She pointed out that OLIS, the legislature's online legislative information system, makes key information readily available and accessible to all. We would like to see this kind of transparency and accessibility in the reporting of lobby activity and ethics reporting, and this bill is an important step in that direction. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And yes, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I certainly intend to support the bill. I think it's a great step forward. But I do have a question.
Go ahead.
In the heat of the legislative sessions, either the long or short sessions, particularly close to the end, it seems like swarms of lobbyists coalesce around an issue, even though they seem not to have a paying client to do so. So does the registration requirement kick in if a lobbyist is simply assisting a friend, a co-lobbyist or a friend in the building, by visiting members of the legislature with whom they have a relationship? So they would not be compensated, but they're still actively lobbying. Would they be required to register also as lobbying for an interest, even though they're not being compensated to do so?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, thank you for the question. This bill does not affect the definition of lobbying or the triggers that require a lobbyist to report to the Ethics Commission, so I believe the same, you know, whether they'd have to do that now within 10 days or under the bill would be the same, and that would look, if they're not getting paid, it would look at the amount of hours they're required that they've spent lobbying that activity, and that's what triggers reporting, depending on the situation.
Madam Chair, that makes me even more enthusiastically in support of the bill, but there seems to be a collegiality that people rely on in lobbying situations where they simply recruit a gang of friends and descend upon legislators. And, you know, that is a way to cover the billionaire in a hurry, but it's not always apparent to legislators what the relationship is between a particular lobbyist and the underlying client. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too, support the bill, and Gina and the rest of the staff and the governor's office have a discussion, mm-hmm. as I have had with one of the gentlemen in the back of the room. And the answer to Senator Farrelly's question is technically, if they spent more than 24 hours lobbying on that particular thing in support of their good friend, you can all look to your left and right back there, that would apply, and or you exceeded the $100 lobbying. However, during the interim, I do believe there's going to be some work done on some loopholes that have occurred unintentionally in who gets to report, how you define the 24 hours, how do you define the $100, so on and so forth. And so there is more work to be done on the transparency issue. I am confident the good staff of the governor and those of the Government Ethics Commission will be on top of that for next session.
Thank you for your comment, Senator Boquist. And I don't see any other questions, so thank you again for your testimony. And we did have one other person signed up, Bill Cross, on this bill from the Capital Club, but I do not see him in the room.
Snooze, you lose.
And he has signed up in support of the bill. So,
Madam Chair, this is the point which you get to say, even if Mr. Cross does show up, do you want to testify or do you want us to move your bill?
Exactly.
Can't have both.
Exactly. Okay, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4134 and open a work session on House Bill 4134. Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The engrossed version, is that the version that
we're
working
on? That's the version.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 4134, the engrossed version, to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farrelly has moved House Bill 4134A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Motion carries. And the chair will volunteer to carry the bill on the floor. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 4134. And I apologize to Representative Barker that I didn't see you sitting there before, but we'll go to your bill next. So I'll open a work session on House Bill 4044. And this bill had a public hearing in a previous committee, so it's here just for a work session. And I do see that Representative Barker has joined us on this bill. Did you want to come forward?
Thank you. Madam Chairman, Vice Chairs, and Committee, I'm for the record, Jeff Barker, House District 28. This bill was a simple bill to help the pawnbrokers on an issue. In my past life, I was the sergeant in charge of the pawn detail at Portland Police, so I know a lot of the people in that business. They had to report by paper, and what we wanted to do is allow them to come into the 21st century and be able to make this anything they have to report they could do electronically, and that's all that bill did. And there was some controversy came up about what was being reported and how long it would stay. As I pointed out in the House, that we know what the Romans did because they wrote it down. They didn't have a computer, and we still have those records. So even if you just write it. But this would makes it a little more efficient for the pawnbrokers throughout the state, and I would appreciate passing the bill. So that's all
for me. Great. Okay, any questions for Representative Barker?
I have a quick question.
Go ahead.
Did you get any good deals from the pawnbrokers?
I had some great deals. My wife has literally told me, quit buying me jewelry.
Okay.
So... Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Barker. And so we are in a work session. Senator Farrelly, did you have a motion?
No, ma'am. I do not have a motion.
You do not have a motion. Okay, Senator Beyer, do you? Or
a motion?
Senator Beyer, would you like to move this bill?
Sure.
Do pass.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 4044A to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 4044A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay, Amen, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
I'll be a temporary no.
A temporary no.
I got to get this across the floor, okay? If you guys give up, I might have
no. And Madam Chair, I will be a no, and I believe I'm. I'll just be a temporary no with along with my colleague.
Nothing is permanent here.
Exactly.
We want it to pass, madam. We just don't want to vote for it.
Okay.
And we're going to make sure that happens.
Aye. And the motion carries.
But I won't vote for it. Even the 16th vote.
We'll ask Senator Prezansky to be our carrier on the floor.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farrioli.
To the temporary no, if we're still looking at written Roman records, there's people concerned that written records could be used as a form of registry. So that's a concern. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'm hoping there's a massive computer crash next week when this is implemented.
Okay.
But it will pass.
Okay. I'm sorry, I was distracted. Did I miss something?
We're moving on.
Okay, so I'll close the work session on House Bill 4044. And we have two more bills, and the first one we're going to take up is House Bill. Is he going to be able to call him? Okay, so should we go to 4143?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4143A. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4143.
There's two more.
B, actually.
For
yeah.
Sure.
B is down what to
do we now? Know? Yes.
4143B.
Okay.
Prohibits landlord from increasing rent during first year of occupancy, requires notice at least 90 days prior to increase in rent after first year of occupancy for month-to-month tenants, increases fee charged to tenants for second or subsequent non-compliance violation of smoking prohibition in lease, requires landlord have secondary egress if required at time of building or renovation, declares emergency effective upon passage. This measure comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And we have several people signed up to testify on this bill, so I'll start with John Van Landingham, Cindy Robert, and Ryan Fisher, if the three of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think I'm supposed to go first. John Van Landingham, I'm a lawyer with Lane County Legal Aid. I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 4143B. I've advocated on behalf of tenants in Lane County for almost 40 years and in this building for about 25 years. I'm going to describe what House Bill 4143B proposes to do and what it used to propose but no longer proposes to do. It covers, just because there's been a lot of discussion about that, and I want to be very clear about what's in the bill. It covers three issues now: rent increases, no smoking fee, and an issue regarding egress from units. The first issue, rent increase, is covered in sections 2 and 3 of the bill. Current law requires that a landlord who wants to raise the rent must give a 30-day written notice. The bill will change that to 90 days for rent increases, and it will provide a change to another provision which says that security deposits can't be increased during the first year of a tenancy. That's the current law, would say that rents can't be increased during the first year of a tenancy. So two things with regard to rent increases. Both of those have to do with month-to-month tenancies. Month-to-month tenancies can be changed by either side, 30 days notice. If a landlord wanted to be able to do fixed rent increases, a landlord can use a fixed-term tenancy, which includes specified rent increases during that period. Fixed-term tenancies automatically roll over to month-to-month unless the sides allow them to terminate. The second issue covered in the bill has to do with fees. Fees are regulated in one of the statutes. This is covered in Section 4 of the bill. They require a written warning notice when a tenant breaks the rules, and on a second offense, the landlord can impose a fee. Current fee for a no-smoking violation is $50. Landlords feel that's not enough of a disincentive. The bill would increase that second violation fee from $50 to $250 for no-smoking violation. Third issue has to do with something we've called egress. In the 2015 session, the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition, of which Cindy and I are faithful members, came to you with a bill, and we were trying to address a specific situation, really, around Portland State, where some landlords were renting out illegal bedrooms as dwelling units with no egress. And so we drafted a provision saying that that's not allowed. Unfortunately, we didn't do a very good job with that, and we are coming back to fix that to make it work so that it doesn't make a bunch of units that are, say, on the 10th floor of a high-rise in Portland, illegal bedrooms or illegal units. So we've worked with Mark Long in the Building Codes Division, and we think we've gotten that right. What the bill does not do, it does not now include three things that were in the bill as introduced. Those were increasing the current requirement for no-cause termination notices. Current law requires that they be at least 30 days during the first year of a tenancy, 60 days after the first year of the tenancy. The bill would have required that to go to 90 days. That's no longer in the bill. The bill also would have restored something called the presumption of retaliation. When the Landlord-Tenant Act was adopted in 1973, it included that. It came from a Uniform Act. That was taken out of the bill, out of the Act, a couple sessions after that. The proposal was to restore that so that if a landlord raised the rent or evicted a tenant within 6 months of a tenant's complaint about repairs, that would be presumed to be retaliation and the landlord would have to rebut it. That is no longer in the bill also. And the third thing that was in the bill initially that's no longer there was a requirement that if a landlord used a no-cause termination notice, the landlord had to pay the tenant a relocation assistance payment of 1 month's rent. That is no longer in the bill. Landlord groups and the association, Oregon Association of Realtors, strongly objected to those three items. Thus, they are no longer in the bill. As the bill now stands, the bill is supported by the Oregon Association of Realtors, the Oregon Home Builders Association, the three state landlord groups. Cindy is going to speak on behalf of the Rental Housing Alliance of Oregon, but also the Oregon Rental Housing Association and the Multifamily Northwest. It's also supported by the Housing Alliance, the Oregon Housing Authorities, the Community Alliance of Tenants, and others. I'd be happy to take questions.
Okay, I think we'll hear from the whole panel and then open it up.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Authorities. The Oregon Housing Authorities run the Housing Choice Voucher Program, and through that program provide $176 million in rental assistance every year to private landlords throughout the state. This is 12,800 private landlords throughout the state. Housing authorities also manage over 15,000 units, public housing units as well as units that they have acquired or developed and are made affordable. As a statewide association that covers all 36 counties, as we've met over the last few years, we have seen the spread of the housing crisis from initially Bend and Portland to all corners of the state. And we feel that there are a number of reasons why this is a good bill. Of the Housing Choice Voucher holders that I mentioned, 60% of them are seniors or people with disabilities who are on fixed income. A rent increase that goes beyond what the Section 8 voucher is allowed to cover means that that tenant will have to move. And finding a place that they can afford, even with the Section 8 voucher at this time, in many communities around the state is extremely difficult. This extra time is going to be very important to them. And then also, as Mr. Van Landingham mentioned, the egress issue is incredibly important. We need units right now, and this is another provision that will make sure that we have as many units available as possible. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I represent the Rental Housing Alliance of Oregon. We are a nonprofit based in Portland. We have about 1,800 members, and 81% of them are landlords with 10 units or fewer, so the real mom-and-pop shop. However, today I'm here speaking on behalf of the three major landlord associations in Oregon. I wanted to just relay to you, everything's been very much said and very well said. I wanted to relay to you that the issue we're having right now, the housing crisis, is a supply versus demand problem. It is not a landlord-tenant problem. And I appreciate the fact that this body is doing as much as it can to help with the supply versus demand issue. In turn, the landlord groups believe we should do what we can to help with stability. And we think the two provisions in this bill having to do with 90-day notification of rent increase and no increases in the first year for month-to-month tenancies is one way we can help with stability. A lot of people have asked what was in the bill before, what got taken out. Mr. Van Landingham already told you, so I actually got rid of one page of my testimony, and I still just leave you with this. And Martin Luther King said the time is right, is always right, to do what is right. And we ask you to support this bill.
Okay, thank you for your testimony and for all the work that has gone into getting to this point. Any questions for this panel? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so thanks again. I think we're going to temporarily close the hearing on House Bill 4143 and open a work session on House Bill 4107. And Aaron, do you want to just quickly tell us what this is? And Representative Davis, if you want to come forward to talk about it.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4107 prohibits Oregon Health Authority from retroactively changing terms of contract with coordinated care organization unless specified conditions are met. This measure does have an emergency clause on it. You have the B6 amendment, Madam Chair. It clarifies the Oregon Health Authority is notified in writing by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that a contract amendment is necessary and explicitly outlines coordinated care organization contract terms and effective dates with Oregon Health Authority. This measure comes to you with no revenue and a fiscal impact statement that is indeterminate was issued on the -B6 amendment.
Okay, which is not yet in the bill. We need to add that?
That is correct, okay. Madam Chair.
Great. And Representative Davis, welcome to Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is John Davis. I'm state representative from House District 26, the fighting 26th. It is a real pleasure to share with you a bill that will solve every problem and every dispute
Madam
that we're
Chair.
Having regarding coordinated
Madam
care
Chair,
organizations.
Do we need to put this witness under oath?
Considering his testimony on the floor, which is why he's here, we probably ought to.
Madam Chair, considering his testimony in the last 30 seconds, we probably ought to.
Well, just remind the witness, this is the Senate Rules Committee.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. House Bill 4107 comes out of long-simmering disputes about retroactive amendments or, quote, clawbacks to coordinated care organization contracts. There's a dispute ongoing right now between a particular CCO and the Oregon Health Authority. This bill does not affect that dispute, and we've, through careful drafting with Senator Bates, with legislative counsel, discussions with the Oregon Health Authority, the governor's office, and the attorney general's office, I believe in the B6 amendments put forth by Senator Bates, ended up with a bill that does not touch existing litigation, as is the clear intent of many members of this legislative body, but sets forth a path for increased transparency in the event that the federal government seeks to require changes to coordinated care organization contracts that may involve, quote, clawbacks of global payments. This bill came across the House floor, I believe, unanimously, except for some members who may have been absent. It came with good support from the Senate Health Care Committee, and I think the B6 amendments represent a good compromise position that will require clear evidence in writing for a clawback or change to a CCO contract from CMS, from the federal government, if one of those changes to a contract is required. I think it's a good step forward for transparency. It's a good step forward for healthcare in the state, and I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Did we have any questions for the representative? OK, Okay. Yes, Senator
Boquist. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify so I understand, because the good representative from the Fighting 26th, I was told that when the good representative from the Fighting 26th was speaking on the floor, there was some sort of confusion and on the intent. So therefore, we needed to have a new amendment brought over to this side. So does the amendment fix whatever the true or false statement of the Fighting 26th was?
Senator Boquist, the B6 amendment, I think, represents the intent of those of us in the House who drafted this bill and the intent of other members who have been interested in it. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other questions, so thanks again for your clarification
like
and for your testimony.
A lawyerly answer.
That's right. You noticed the Fighting 26th went away real quick, too, by the way. But
okay, thanks again. And members, we are in a work session, so Senator Ferrioli, did you have a motion
yes,
on
ma'am.
The dash B6?
Thank you, madam. The dash B6, Madam Chair, I move the dash B6 amendment to HB 4107, the B engrossed version.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ferrioli has moved the dash B6 amendment to House Bill 4107B. Is there discussion on the amendment? Objection to the amendment? Okay, the amendment is adopted. And Senator Ferrioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 4107 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Ferrioli has moved House Bill 4107B as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries, and probably should ask Senator Bates to carry this on the floor. And I'll close the work session. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 4107B, and committee will stand at ease for just a moment. Committee is. Okay, committee will come back to order, and I will reopen our public hearing on House Bill 4143B. And members of the audience, I want to explain something that's going on. We're about to resume our public testimony on this bill, but we had a slight glitch in our system whereby the bill originally got posted with an A after the bill number, whereas it should have been a B. So we corrected that problem, but what that means is that we're not going to be able to actually vote on the bill until it's been correctly posted for an hour under our one-hour notice. So that hour will be up at 5:42. So we'll complete our public hearing, then we'll go into recess. We'll come back at 5:42 so that we can go into a work session and vote on the bill. So don't worry when you don't see the bill move right away, but
Amen.
That's what's happening. And Vice Chair Ferrioli.
If some observers of the process think that question is a frivolous question, budget bills have been litigated and overturned because the posting didn't match the bill under the committee's possession. So it isn't a small thing. It just goes to show our procedures matter. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we'll go back to our witness list, and we'll call Quinn Studdite, I think, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and then Sean Gillians and Sean Cleave. The three of you would like to come forward.
And could you take an hour or so to...
Yeah, you're welcome to talk as slowly as you
want. Expand your testimony.
We're going to be here for a while, so... So whoever would like to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gillians. I think it says Gillians Cleave up there, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. When we were signed in, we didn't know which one of us would be here. So I will cover the Oregon Association of Realtors. We are in support of House Bill 4143. I would guess B in its current form before you. Madam Chair, you've heard a lot about sort of the negotiations that have gone on and the components of the bill. The one thing that I just wanted to stress, though, is we've sort of had conversations around housing this particular legislative session. For all my years here, you all have said to diverse stakeholders, go out in the hall and work it out amongst yourselves when we had varying opinions. That's exactly what we did on this bill. We had a number of stakeholder meetings over a series of months in the interim and then inside this building as well. That's why you see a broad coalition of folks in support from various positions on landlord-tenant housing issues as well. With that, Madam Chair, happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Quinn Stuteheit. I'm from Albany. I'm retiree and landlord of three units, so I don't have a coalition or anybody sitting with me on this. But I am a new real estate broker, so I think now there's a conflict that I know that he's with them. So one of the reasons I came forward is there are other circumstances that arise where a landlord has to give 30-day notice. I've used month-to-month rental agreements for the last 10 to 12 years. I chose those over lease agreements because when you get into a bad situation with a tenant, time is against both of us. And in some cases, 30 days is too long. An example of a recent dealing I just had with a tenant was I signed them on in October on a month-to-month rental agreement. And in Christmas, I'm one of those landlords. I like to work with my tenants. I give them a reduction in rent during Christmas for 1 month. And even though it affects me financially, individually, I still think that's the right thing to do during those times. And one of the first indications that I had was something wrong was that that tenant didn't answer that gift. That concerned me right off. I didn't hear anything back from them. Normally I do. Second thing was is that I just paid taxes, and the following day I got notice from that tenant that they asked to postpone paying their rent until the 12th of the month. Financially, that hits pretty hard when you have to delay. My mortgage is due on the 5th. Paying on the 12th was not exactly a good thing for me, and then a reduction in rents that month also took its toll. So that was the first indication that I had was something was wrong. The second one was an issue with the pet at the end of December, them having a pet. I don't allow those on the residence because they're expensive to maintain. My personal units are. I keep them very nice. And so I had to deal with that. Then I had to deal with the tenant that was lying to me about having the pet inside. So rather than this young couple getting a negative mark from me, my option was to choose the 30-day notice and give them 30-day notice to leave. I realize that falls under the one-year category in this particular bill, but that was my option. If it was past the year mark and we had to go from 60 days to 90 days, it would be difficult. 30 days, like I told you, was more than enough time. And it was an issue that I had to deal with them, and it was made both of us uncomfortable because I'm having to deal with a client that's not being truthful. They think they're having to deal with somebody like me that's having to tell them to move. I've very rarely had to tell another tenant to move. Only a few times have I had to ask a tenant to leave, and I haven't had to, fortunately, haven't had to evict anybody in that period of time, which says to me that I'm screening my tenants fairly well. But every once in a while you do get somebody in there that's not a good fit. So that's why I choose month to month, and I believe that 9 months under the circumstances can be quite difficult to a landlord. I think if more people knew about this, I found out about 3 days ago, I think if more people knew about this, they might come forward, but I just feel that under the circumstances, it should remain at the 60 days that it is.
And Madam Chair, we're happy to have him belong to the real estate community, and some of the objections he just raised are exactly the same ones we had, which is why that's no longer in the bill. I see that my colleague here actually has the A engrossed, which is what was posted, and maybe that's the concern there, but the no-cause notice provisions have been removed from the bill, so you are part of a coalition now, and you were well taken care of in that. So the no-cause provisions are not in the current bill as it sits. The two remaining pieces that are left for your month-to-month tenants are in the first year you can't raise rent of a month-to-month tenancy, and you must give a 90-day notice just of a rent increase but not of termination, and for the exact reasons you mentioned, sir.
The increase is in the first year, because I am catching this a little late in the game, but the rent increases in the first year. There are also circumstances that come up where that may be necessary. And one of the things I read about from some of the views that were put in was the bait and switch type thing, where you try to get a tenant in and then raise their rate right away. I don't participate in anything like that. On the reverse side of that, I just had new tenants move in a month ago, and it was kind of the opposite of that. They're students. They don't make a lot of money. They had no credit references. And I had advertised the rent for $750 a month, which brought it into the fair rental value area. And in this case, I offered them to reduce the rent to $700 and then increase it later on. I don't know if a rental agreement would cover that if I put that in there at the very beginning. I'm not a legal guy, so I don't know. But there are other circumstances that come up where you may have to raise the rent, and I'm not doing it to be, you know, arbitrary or retaliation or anything like that. It's just things come up. Increased water sewer bills, increase in taxes, increased mortgage payments, whatever. So we should be able to have that flexibility to make those increases, but at the same token, there should be penalties for the folks that are doing it fraudulently or, you know, trying to do the bait and switch tactics.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, the last witness never did have to do an eviction. That's extraordinary. Well, how long does it take to get a forcible entry and detainer and a eviction process, and what's the cost? Well, maybe we'll hold those questions for another time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The cost, but the guy who can answer that is right back there.
I can see that.
Mr. Van Landingham, I know, is in the back. And
you
sure
feel his hot gaze upon the...
Okay, any other questions for this?
You didn't get your question.
Okay.
No, but these
thank
gentlemen
you both
indicated
for your
they couldn't answer my question.
And next, I'll call Sarah Keefe and John Bartholomew. Good evening. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and we're the state-level member organization for 48 domestic and sexual violence programs across the state of Oregon, representing communities and tribal nations. So we're here because our members and our board of directors identify housing as the primary barrier for survivors in Oregon right now to living safe and healthy lives. It's well known that domestic violence is one of the main reasons that women and children are homeless in the U.S. And here in the state of Oregon, last year, our member programs report over 12,000 unmet requests for emergency shelter in the state of Oregon. You all know that there's a crisis. That's why this conversation has been so strong this year, and we thank you all for your dedication to this issue. We're here in strong support of House Bill 4143. Survivors trying to establish safety after leaving a violent relationship are economically vulnerable and often newly supporting themselves and their families without the help of a second income. In all too many cases, survivors facing a sudden rent increase face the terrible choice between homelessness and returning to an unsafe home, risking further violence for themselves and their children. Please support the reasonable protections proposed for tenants in House Bill 4143 to help protect stability for survivors during this housing crisis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I am the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon, a nonprofit of over 500,000 members in Oregon, representing the interests of Oregonians over the age of 50. And we just want to add our support to House Bill 4143B because of the way it can help seniors in this state. Given the fact that there was no Social Security COLA this year, we have seniors who are renting places, and any increase has a large impact on them. And if they feel the need that it means they have to move. It's more difficult for them to move, so a little bit more time is going to be helpful. And anybody with mobility issues is going to have a hard time finding a place that actually can take or address their needs with accessibility, whether they, you know, need a shower instead of a tub or a place with no stairs. So having a little bit more time if they need to find a new place is really important. And with that, I thank you and urge your support for this legislation.
Well, thank you both for your testimony. Did we have any questions? Okay, I don't see any questions, so well, thank you again. And that completes our sign-up sheet. Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify on House Bill 4143B? Okay, so again, audience, we are going to go into a recess. Because of a posting problem, we will not be able to open our work session until 5:42, so that's in just about half an hour. So if you want to see the bill voted out, that is our intention, is to take it up in a work session at that time. So for the moment, I guess we'll just be in recess until 5:42. Members, please be prompt. 5:42 prompt. Okay. Okay. Committee will come back to order, and thank you everybody for being here so promptly. So we had completed our public hearing, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4143B and open a work session on House Bill 4143B. And so we are ready to move the bill. And
do we need to ask for any other public testimony just to be legal?
I don't think so, but
if you just ask them,
I would be happy to do so. Is there anyone who didn't get a chance to testify on House Bill 4143 who wants to do so now?
We're legal now.
Come at your own peril.
Okay. So I think we're ready to move the bill. Senator Beyer, would you make the motion?
Madam Chair, I would move. Is that the right one? 4143A to B. Well, it's not the way it is on the agenda. 4143B to the Senate floor.
Okay, Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 4143B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes, ma'am. I'll be voting no on serving notice of a potential minority report.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I would like to declare a potential conflict of interest out of abundance of caution. I'm a part of a large class of landlords.
Okay, thank you. Your conflict is noted.
And Madam Chair, I'm a small class of minorities, but serving notice of possible minority report, too. So.
Okay, so it sounds like we need to call the roll on the motion. Eamon, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Bofus?
No.
Senator
Gray? Aye.
Vice Chair Fairley?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. And the motion carries. And we will ask Senator Dembro to carry the bill on the floor.
And we're done?
That completes our work for today.
No, ma'am. It only completes your work for today. We have an hour to complete our work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'll close the work session on House Bill 4143, and we're adjourned.
So, Aaron's
43, and we're adjourned.
So, Aaron's 41.